We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
This is Lynn Sloniker with the WGXC News Update. Amelia Teasdale is reporting in the Columbia paper, Ichabod Crane Superintendent of Schools George Zinni will leave the district when his contract expires next June. Zinni made the announcement at a school board meeting Tuesday, August 2nd. Reading from a letter he addressed to school board president Anthony Welcome, Zinni said it was time for him to explore other options. Zinni has been with the district since January of 2013. He came to Ichabod from a school district in Massachusetts, replacing the previous interim superintendent, Lee Bordick. Bordick served the district for 2 years. Board members praised Zinni for his work on behalf of the district, but they did not discuss how they plan to move forward with finding his replacement. Read the full story in the Columbia paper. Mid-Hudson News Network is reporting sales tax revenue is up in the Hudson Valley. Putnam County came in first, followed by Columbia County with a 5.4% increase, followed by Rockland and Sullivan counties. Ulster's revenue rose by 2.7%. Dutchess County followed with a 2.1% increase, followed by Greene County at 1.8%. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. And Andrea Sears has this story from Public News Service.
The Obama administration's Clean Power Plan was finalized a year ago, and a new report says that plan provides big benefits for businesses. Commercial customers are responsible for nearly a third of all electricity-related carbon pollution nationwide. According to Dr. Marilyn Brown at Georgia Tech's School of Public Policy, implementing the Clean Power Plan could produce significant savings by 2030.
Bills for electricity could be reduced by 6.7% if states were to include energy efficiency as a strong component of their compliance approach.
In New York State, that translates to savings of $138 million a year on electric bills for commercial building owners and occupants. The state is committed to meeting or exceeding the goals of the Clean Power Plan, and Peter Iwanowitz, director of Environmental Advocates of New York, says the state will be spending upwards of $5 billion over the next 10 years on energy efficiency programs.
We're really well positioned to drive down the amount of electricity and overall energy that our building sectors and our residential sectors consume, and that's going to be a big benefit down the line.
Iwanowitz says every dollar invested in energy efficiency produces $3 of economic benefits. Some states are planning to build new power plants to meet projected needs, but Brown points out that by switching buildings to new heating and cooling systems and LED lighting, energy efficiency can reduce or eliminate the need to generate more power.
We can meet energy service requirements with these more efficient products and not lock in a next generation of high-priced power plants.
Although the U.S. Supreme Court has stayed enforcement of the Clean Power Plan while it faces legal challenges, New York is actively pursuing a clean energy future. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
This has been the WGXC News Update. Please visit newsroom.wgxe.org to find these stories, weather, public meetings, and more.
If it doesn't. Mission.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News. Radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news. Human Rights Watch reported that the Turkish government last week shut down 23 radio stations and 16 television channels under the state of emergency law there. Altogether, 131 newspapers, news agencies, publishers, television, and radio stations were forced to close July 27th in a backlash from the conservative government after the recent failed military coup. Quote, "The government crackdown is on media outlets and journalists it accuses of being linked to the Fethullah Gulen movement, which it blames for the foiled military coup," unquote, said Emma Sinclair Webb, the Turkey director at Human Rights Watch. Quote, "In the absence of any evidence of their role or participation in the violent attempt to overthrow the government, we strongly condemn this accelerated assault on the media, which further undermines Turkey's democratic credentials," unquote. The government also arrested many individual journalists, according to the group. Ars Technica reported that last week that Illinois is the latest state to require law enforcement officials to seek court approval before deploying cell site simulators, so-called stingray devices, which can locate and track a person's cell phone without their knowledge. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner signed the Citizens Privacy Protection Act, with law enforcement officials forced to, quote, "include a description of the nature and capabilities of the cell site simulator device to be used and the manner and method of its deployment, including whether the cell site simulator device will obtain data from non-target communication devices," unquote. The law also makes law enforcement immediately delete any information collected about others' non-targets. Some stingrays can intercept calls and text messages. Others just collect metadata, and they can collect all sorts of records near their location, including from criminals and folks just passing by. California, Washington, Virginia, Minnesota, and Utah mandate a warrant for use of the devices, and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice last year created new policies that require a warrant for stingray use in most cases. Safe Tech for Schools uploaded this video of Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein talking about Wi-Fi in schools and saying, quote, "We should not be subjecting children's brains to Wi-Fi screens in schools. It's not okay," unquote. Let's hear the question and the full context.
I'm Tracy Douglas, and I'm a kindergarten teacher. And my school district is rapidly moving towards one-to-one computers throughout the district. Can you speak to the health issues?
Great. Wonderful. Health issues, social issues, you know, you name it. But to be staring at screens, you know, I mean, we already know that kids who get put in front of TVs, you know, instead of interacting, this is not good in all kinds of ways and is just, it's not good for their cognitive development. It's not good for their social development. I mean, that is incredible that kids in kindergarten, we should be moving away from screens at all levels of education, not moving into them. And this is another corporate ruse, you know, this is another gimmick to try to make a buck, make big bucks, in fact, and education and teachers and communities suffer. So we need to stand up to that. Thank you.
What about the wireless?
Yes, right. I mean, we should not be subjecting kids' brains especially to that. And, you know, we don't follow that issue in this country, but in Europe where they do, you know, they have good precautions around wireless, maybe not good enough, you know, because it's very hard to study this stuff. You know, we make guinea pigs out of whole populations and then we discover how many die. You know, and this is like the paradigm for how public health works in this country, and it's outrageous, you know. I mean, this is why we need to take back, really, not just our schools, you know, and our electoral system, you know, we really need to take back the whole institution of how we create health, how we protect health, and our research institutions as well need to be publicly funded and publicly accountable, not for the device manufacturers, not sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies. You know, it's no surprise that people, you know, people don't buy what our regulatory agencies are telling us. We've completely lost trust in them when they are being run by lobbyists like the, you know, a vice president from Monsanto, who's one of the assistant directors of the, not the DEA, which one? The FDA, yes,
I mean,
right.
We shouldn't trust Nestle to give us dietitian advice. This was an Obama appointee, okay?
Yes.
That did that.
Yeah. And that,
thank
right
you.
There.
That was my question about the Wi-Fi radiation.
Okay, excellent. Good. Some other folks?
The Guardian reports that when HTML5 was introduced, it included a battery status API that allowed website owners to, quote, "see the percentage of battery life left in a device as well as the time it will take to discharge or the time it will take to charge if connected to a power source, unquote. That enables tracking online, not just its intended use to let website owners switch users to low-power versions of their sites and web apps. Now, security researchers from Princeton University have proven that the battery status indicator is being used to track users. Quote, Steve Engelhardt and Arvind Narayan found two tracking scripts that use the API to, quote, fingerprint, unquote, a specific device, allowing them to continuously identify it across multiple contexts, unquote, The Guardian reported. Lukas Olznik was one of the four researchers who first warned about the abuses possible with the battery status API in 2015. Quote, some companies may be analyzing the possibility of monetizing the access to battery levels, quote, he writes. Quote, when battery is running low, people might be prone to some otherwise different decisions. In such circumstances, users will agree to pay more for a service, unquote. And any app that can also track users' locations is dangerous for many reasons. I'm Tom Rowe reporting for Wavefarm Radio and WGXC.
From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL Audio News for Friday, August 5th, 2016. This program is produced by the ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, and features news highlights compiled from the ARRL letter, found on the web at arrl.org. I'm Sean Kutzko, KX9X. In this week's report, the Dayton Hamvention is headed for Xenia in 2017. The FCC proposes rule changes in response to ARRL's symbol rate petition. And Skylar Fennell, KD0WHB, is the 2016 Bill Pasternak WA6ITF Memorial Young Ham of the Year. Those stories and others, plus Bruce Page, KK5DO, with this week's satellite update, all coming up now.
Hi, I'm ARRL member Jennifer Harris, N5LRF of Duncanville, Texas, and you're listening to ARRL Audio News.
After 52 years at Hera Arena and its entire 64-year history in the greater Dayton area, Hamvention announced on August 1st that it would relocate to the Greene County Fairgrounds in Xenia, Ohio. The new venue is about 16 miles east of downtown Dayton off U.S. Route 35 and north of Xenia. On June 29th, the amateur radio community was stunned to learn that Hera Arena would shut down at the end of August, leaving Hamvention homeless, at least until this week's big reveal. We appreciate and value all the time and effort the many partners, in particular the Greene County Agricultural Society, the Greene County Board of Commissioners, and the Greene County Convention and Visitors Bureau, have put into helping Hamvention find the right venue to continue our long history here in the Miami Valley, Hamvention General Chair Ron Kramer, KD8ENJ, said on August 1st. We look forward to a long and mutually prosperous relationship. Kramer has said that Hamvention spent many hours over the last few years evaluating possible new locations, and he has assured visitors that their current accommodations and outside events already planned for Hamvention 2017 should not be affected. Hamvention chief spokesman and board member Mike Coulter, W8CI, made clear that the move to Xenia was not done in desperation. Montgomery County didn't have anything for us, he told ARRL. We looked exhaustively. The key thing is that we plan to have a five-star event, he said of Hamvention 2017. We'll put a lot of time and energy into it. The move to Xenia could prove to be a huge economic bonanza for the city and for Greene County. Hamvention attracts some 25,000 visitors each May. Its annual economic impact has been estimated at between $15 and $17 million to the Dayton-Montgomery County area, and some, if not most, of that benefit now could migrate eastward down U.S. 35. The FCC has proposed to revise the Amateur Service Part 97 rules in response to the ARRL's so-called symbol rate petition for rulemaking, RM11708, filed in late 2013, and it has invited comments on its recommended changes. ARRL had asked the FCC to change the Part 97 rules to delete the symbol rate limit and replace it with a maximum bandwidth for data emissions of 2.8 kHz on amateur frequencies below 29.7 MHz. While tentatively concluding that a specific bandwidth limitation for RTTY and data was not necessary, the FCC nonetheless invited comments on whether it should set emission bandwidth standards for amateur service medium frequency and high frequency RTTY and data emissions. Under the current rules, specified digital codes in Part 97 may be used with a symbol rate that does not exceed 300 baud for frequencies below 28 MHz, with the exception of 60 meters, and 1,200 baud in the 10-meter band. The baud rate limits were adopted in 1980 when the FCC amended Part 97 to specify ASCII as a permissible digital mode. Comments in the proceeding will be due 60 days after the date that the NPRM appears in the Federal Register. At its July 2016 meeting, the ARRL Board of Directors approved revisions concerning the management and governance of its National Traffic System program. In response, some NTS participants have proposed to form a new organization with the stated purpose of engaging in current NTS activity independent of ARRL. This action, in part, was a reaction to ARRL's announcement regarding the creation of an enhanced emergency communications plan scheduled for implementation later this year. The ARRL plan will address the role of programs such as NTS, which can provide important capabilities to ARRL partner agencies, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Salvation Army. In a statement issued August 3rd by ARRL, the League said it believes the existing ARRL NTS program will rise to meet these new demanding requirements. NTS resources are already well-established networks and have a long history of reliable operation. We encourage all NTS participants to be involved in current National Traffic System activities by continuing their existing assignments and duties, the statement said. However, if NTS members wish to explore alternative programs like the one recently proposed, we do not wish to discourage that exploration. The League encourages any activity that strengthens the national emergency communications infrastructure, provides network redundancy, and refines and maintains the critical skills of radio amateurs who daily serve their communities with communication training activities and responses to local and regional emergencies, the statement concluded. Online, via podcast, and on repeaters like the W4WVP repeater serving Arlington County, Virginia, you're listening to ARRL Audio News. Now with this week's satellite update, here's Bruce Page, KK5DO.
On the Houston AmSatNet the other night, we had a story about lithium-ion batteries out of the University of California at Irvine. The current lithium-ion batteries used can be cycled only 5,000 to 6,000 times before they lose the ability to charge. A UCI doctoral candidate, Maya Lei Tai, has solved the problem. From the story, to solve the brittleness of the nanowires, she coated the gold nanowires in a manganese dioxide shell and then encased the assembly in an electrolyte made of plexiglass-like gel. In doing this, the lithium-ion batteries will be able to be cycled over 200,000 times, making them last a lifetime. Just think of computers, smartphones, appliances, and cars with batteries that never need to be replaced. Also, one of the best uses of this lithium-ion battery for us will be on a satellite. Thanks to Computer World for this story. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO, for the ARRL Audio News.
AMSAT North America Vice President of Engineering Jerry Buxton, N0JY, reports that the Fox-1B CubeSat, or RAD-FXSat, flight unit has been assembled and is now undergoing various stages of testing before it is put through environmental testing in August for completion by early September. Launch is scheduled for January 20th. Fox-1B is a joint mission by AMSAT and the Institute for Space and Defense Electronics at Vanderbilt University. It hosts a technology experiment by Vanderbilt University, as well as an analog FM amateur radio payload. During a recent test stop in Fox Labs, most of the testing was streamed live on YouTube to give enthusiasts an opportunity to look over Buxton's shoulder as he conducted tests on the flight unit along with other Fox engineering team members. Those tests have been archived on YouTube. Fox-1B is expected to be back in Fox Labs around August 11th for another round of tests, and live streaming will be available during those tests as well. The ARRL National Parks on the Air program is now in its eighth month, and more than 440 of the 484 eligible NPS units have been activated, with over 540,000 QSOs confirmed in Logbook of the World. Despite a rough summer for propagation, plenty of activators have been on the air, and it's not too late for you to become a new activator or chaser. The 100th birthday of the National Park Service is August 25th, and several parks will be active during the Centennial Week. See the National Parks on the Air Facebook group for a list of stations active during the actual Centennial Week, or to register your own activation. There are 31 activations scheduled for August 4th through the 10th, including two of the rarest NPOTA units, President's Park in Washington, D.C., and Toro Synagogue in Rhode Island. Details about these and other upcoming activations can be found on the NPOTA activations calendar. The FCC has imposed fines on a California radio amateur after concluding they broke FCC rules and the Communications Act. The FCC Enforcement Bureau imposed a $25,000 penalty on William F. Crowell, W6WBJ of Diamond Spring, for intentionally interfering with the transmissions of other radio amateurs and transmitting prohibited communications, including music. The forfeiture represents the full amount proposed in a December 2015 Notice of Apparent Liability for Forfeiture, and the FCC said in a lengthy August 2nd forfeiture order, is based on the full base forfeiture amount as well as an upward adjustment reflecting Mr. Crowell's decision to continue his misconduct after being warned. Mr. Crowell does not deny that he made the transmissions that prompted the NAL in this proceeding, but argues, in large part, that those transmissions were protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, the forfeiture order said. In multiple responses to the NAL, Crowell not only argued that the enforcement action was directed at the content of his transmissions, which were protected by the Constitution, but were justified on the basis of other operators' actions. It is well established that regulation of radio in general does not violate the First Amendment or the Communications Act, the Commission's forfeiture order said, and courts have made clear that this conclusion applies to the amateur service as well. The Enforcement Bureau concluded that Crowell willfully and repeatedly violated the Communications Act and FCC rules by intentionally causing interference to other amateur radio operators and transmitting prohibited communications, including music. The Bureau said that after reviewing Crowell's arguments, it found no reason to cancel, withdraw, or reduce the penalty it had imposed last December.
Hi, I'm ARRL member Dave Pasco, KM3T of Amherst, New Hampshire, and you're listening to ARRL Audio News.
Amateur Radio Newsline has announced that 17-year-old Skylar Fennell, KD0WHB, an ARRL member from Denver, Colorado, is the 2016 Bill Pasternak WA6ITF Memorial Young Ham of the Year. The recent Denver School of the Arts Honors graduate and amateur extra licensee was introduced to amateur radio when he was a high school freshman, but his interest in electronics began in fourth grade. After starting an amateur radio club at my high school, we all wanted to be part of a high-altitude balloon launch, he explained on his QRZ.com profile. After fundraising and a number of designs, we finally launched with the Edge of Space Sciences, or EOSS. He worked with the EOSS amateur radio-equipped balloon launches of the AB0BX STEM School Amateur Radio Club in nearby Littleton. An Eagle Scout at 13, Skyler has combined his interest in cycling and amateur radio, assembling a bicycle mobile setup with VHF and UHF radios. He will formally be recognized as Young Ham of the Year during the Huntsville Hamfest on August 20th. And finally, ARRL Audio News will be changing our podcast distribution method. Beginning with the September 2nd episode, all ARRL podcasts, including ARRL Audio News, will be distributed primarily through blueberry.com. That's blueberry.com. A link to the new location will be posted on the Audio News landing page at ARRL.org. Repeaters which air Audio News should begin downloading the episodes directly from blueberry.com as soon as possible. That concludes ARRL Audio News for this week. Our thanks to all contributors to this week's report. ARRL Audio News is produced by the American Radio Relay League, the National Association for Amateur Radio. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at ARRL.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment about Audio News, email us at audionews@arrl.org. This program is copyright 2016 ARRL. All rights reserved. Until next week, I'm Sean Kutzko, KX9X, 73, and thanks for listening.
Thank you and good morning. Governor, welcome to the historic city of Hudson and beautiful Columbia County. We're delighted to have you here this morning, joined by Public Service Commission Chair Audrey Zibel. I would like to begin by welcoming not only the governor and the chair, but all of you, elected officials, all of you citizens of Columbia County who are interested in this important topic of broadband. From the Regional Economic Development Councils, to the upstate revitalization initiatives, the governor has taken a new approach to spurring economic development upstate, one that invests in our local communities and transforms them into economic generators of tomorrow. Broadband is one of the most important components to ensuring infrastructure is equipped to meet the demands of the 21st century. I can tell you firsthand, as all of you know as well, that having limited access to broadband poses serious concerns for businesses, government, educational institutions who have to compete with others in urban areas who have broadband services. Advancing broadband technology has been a priority of the governor's and the Capital Region Economic Development Council, which I'm proud to serve on. And through the strong partnership, large investments from state and successful programs like New York Broadband, our goal of ensuring every resident in the Capital Region and throughout the state will have access to high-speed internet is becoming a reality. Today's announcement is an important milestone in this plan and a perfect example of what we can achieve when government comes together and delivers on the needs of the community. The new New York broadband program is making a difference in the way communities communicate, especially for schools, households, and community institutions like this library. And we will only see this progress continue to grow. I want to thank the governor again for his dedication and commitment to ensuring that no New Yorker is left behind or forgotten with respect to the technology issues of the 21st century. I look forward to working with the state and our local governments to continue to build on the progress that has been made, and I am confident that the announcements today will send a message of opportunity and success to other communities throughout the state and across the nation. I would now like to introduce and welcome the chair of the New York State Public Service Commission, Audrey Zibelman. Commissioner.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here. For those of you who don't know what we do, the Public Service Commission oversees the telecommunications industry in New York as well as electric and gas. And what that means is that what we care about is for every day that every New Yorker, when you turn on your lights, when you turn on your heat, when you use your phone, you have the most modern, advanced system. And I'm absolutely delighted to talk about our accomplishments that we're being able to achieve under the leadership of Governor Cuomo today. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge two people who have been really instrumental in us getting there. One is Bob Puckett, who is the president of the New York State Telecommunications Association. Bob. And one of our partners, Jim Becker, president of Middleburg Telephone. So I get the chance to talk to you about what Broadband for All is all about. As Michael said, access to high-speed internet is essential for growing and competing in the 21st century global economy. We all know that. The New York considers high-speed broadband to be speeds over 100 megabits. Governor Cuomo talks about New York leading. We are the only state that has this commitment to speed. High-speed broadband makes a significant difference in everyday life. When you download an HD movie, if you don't have high speed, you're talking about 2 to 3, sometimes 5 hours. If it's high speed, we're talking about 11 minutes. If you use a credit card, 5 times faster with high-speed broadband. So what that means is today we have 2.4 million homes and businesses in New York that lack access to high-speed internet. That lack of access stunts the growth of our communities. It limits opportunities, really, for too many people. Governor Cuomo's vision was to have broadband for all New Yorkers at 100 megabits at least by the end of 2018. Today, we're announcing 4 actions to expand broadband for all. This January, the Public Service Commission approved the Charter-Time Warner merger under the condition that Charter would increase internet speeds to 100 megabits. Charter is upgrading service for more than 2 million upstate homes and businesses to that speed. Their original condition required them to get to that upgrade by the end of 2018. I'm very pleased to announce that Charter has committed to us that they will complete the 2 million upgrades this winter, nearly 2 years before their requirement. As part of the merger commitment, Charter also committed to building 145,000 additional connections. Today, we're announcing the first 6 target counties. So what that means is that by mid-2017, the vast majority of customers in these areas are going to have access to 100 megabits or more. We're also unveiling the first 25 awards under the state's complementary broadband grant program. The grants are going to enable local governments to connect 30,000 homes with high-speed internet for the first time. The Capital Region is being awarded $6.2 million from the broadband program. And what that means is that 338,613 homes in this region are going to be receiving expanded high-speed internet, including 2.5 million for Columbia County and expanded speeds and service for 14,530 homes. With these actions, 97% of New York homes for the first time are going to have access to high-speed broadband. But anyone knows that working for Governor Cuomo, we're not finished. So today, I'm proud to say we're launching the RFP to reach the remaining New Yorkers in our most rural areas. The RFP seeks bidders who will build in the most remote parts of the state, and recipients will be announced later this year. And to complete the broadband expansion, we're going to issue a third and final RFP at the end of this year. I'm very proud to say that we're on track to meet Governor Cuomo's ambitious goals. Now, if a picture is worth a thousand words, I would say this one is worth a zillion megabits. We're going to go from here in 2016 to what this looks like in 2017 and what this looks like in 2018. It is broadband for all. Thank you. And now have the pleasure to introduce the person that I work for who has continuously demonstrates to me what true leadership is about, Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, this is an exciting day, and it's my pleasure to be here. First, it's my pleasure to be back in Hudson. I'll tell you a little secret. When I am off duty, not that I'm ever really off duty, when you're governor, sort of a 24/7 job. But I live in Westchester, and I love to come up with Sandy and the girls because Hudson is just so beautiful, and it's such a beautiful way to spend the day on the weekend. So I come up often, but it's good to be here in my official capacity. First to Michael Tucker, who does a really great job. He's a pro. Let's give him a round of applause. Audrey Zibelman, who has been a phenomenal leader for the PSC, and this week, really, you've seen the accomplishments that the PSC has brought. This state is going to be the leading state in the nation in terms of clean energy, thanks to what Audrey has done. So, between that and broadband, I think she's earned her pay and more. Let's give her another round of applause. And to Kathy Marchione and Phil Amador and Dee Dee Barrett, who are my partners in the legislature, none of this happens without them. This was a $500 million This was a $500 million investment, which is a lot of money on anyone's budget. And if the state hadn't made this commitment, this wouldn't happen. So let's give them another round of applause, and I thank them for it. Let me say this, a little context, if I can. Complicated problems. This nation has a lot of complicated problems. This state has a lot of complicated problems. We just went through these political conventions. Everyone's angry. Everybody's frustrated. A lot of complications. I always believe that as complicated as the situation is as simple as it is if you can just get the emotion out of it and look at it honestly and candidly. Situation we had in the state of New York for many, many years was that the upstate economy, what's upstate defined as? North of the Bronx, right? That's upstate. Hudson Valley, upstate. That was one economy. And the New York City economy was a second different economy. And the New York City economy was very strong, and it has been strong, ups and downs over the past 40 years, but basically the line has been up. Hudson Valley, upstate New York, basically the line has been down for 40 years. That is the honest truth. Well, you can't say that. Why not? Well, because it's too stark, but it's true. And if you don't acknowledge the problem, you will never solve it. That is the first rule in life, in any relationship. When you look in the mirror, if you're not willing to acknowledge a problem, you're not going to solve it. We had two economies in this state, and the state government in Albany was more focused on New York City. Why? Because that's where most of the people live, that's where most of the wealth is, that's where the media is. So the state government focused on New York City. And the upstate Hudson Valley communities got less assistance from the state. At the same time, over those 40 or so years, a lot of what the state did actually made it worse because the state was raising taxes. So now, if you're upstate, you're Hudson Valley, and the taxes are going up, 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 and the economy is already fragile, it increases the exodus of businesses. And when the businesses leave, people leave. All those years, you see young people leaving generation after generation, how many parents would say to me, you know, I couldn't tell my children to stay because there's no future for them. So they left. And that was the story. And it got worse, and it compounded itself, and nobody would even admit it. And the political system was all focused on New York City. That's where the political contributions came from. That's where the media outlets were. And the people who were fighting for upstate, like Kathy, Dee Dee, Phil, Hudson Valley, they were fighting against an overwhelming majority. You look at both the Assembly and the Senate, they come from downstate New York. And it's very easy when you're a legislator. They say, I want to do for my district. Well, how about your colleagues who have different districts? I wish them well, but I want to do for my district. And that went on for a lot of years. The stark difference in this administration is we acknowledged it, and we admitted it, and we said it, and we corrected it. And we have done a 180-degree turn. We first said, you have to stop raising taxes because you're chasing everyone away. And just because the people in New York City can afford it, who, by the way, don't really pay property taxes, that doesn't mean it works for the rest of the state. Every year, we have reduced taxes again. Today, every person in this room pays a lower tax rate than they did 6 years ago. Middle class up to $300,000, lowest income tax rate in 70 years, believe it or not. So reduce taxes overall. Second, give special attention to those areas that need more help. When people say, well, how are you governor of the entire state? How can you justify giving more help to upstate New York than downstate New York? You know what I say? Because upstate New York needs more help than downstate New York. I have no problem. You have three children. I love them all the same. Yes, but if you have one that needs more help, you give that child more help. And you don't apologize for it. It's your responsibility. And that's how I've seen my responsibility. It has been a dramatic shift. We have invested a lot of money in upstate New York, $25 billion we've invested in upstate New York. This administration has invested more in upstate New York, Hudson Valley, than any administration in the history of the state of New York. And I'm proud of that. Now, within what we need to do, lower taxes, investment credits, et cetera, marketing of New York and marketing of the areas that need assistance, probably the single most important issue that we needed to address was this. Why? Broadband. It sounds like it's something that is high-tech people use, and it's really not important for day-to-day life. This is everything. This is everything. This is infrastructure for today. This is what the road system was in the 50s. You need roads. Why? Otherwise, you can't get there. If you don't have a road, you can't develop the area because you can't get to the area. If you don't have broadband, there is no discussion. Michael Tucker is going to sit with a business and try to pitch a business coming to Columbia County without broadband? Forget it. I'm going to tell my kids I'm buying a second home in Columbia County. Oh, it's beautiful, nice, let's go. No broadband. Forget it. You're on your own. Call will miss you. You know, it's a very simple conversation. You cannot be competitive without access to broadband. It is Eisenhower's highway road system of the 50s. It's what Governor Smith did, DeWitt Clinton did with the Erie Canal. It's what we did with the New York State Thruway system. You have to be able to get there. Broadband is that basic a requirement. Now, when you go to the map, can you go to the map that the areas, Quinn? Whoever has the map, the 2016 map. Now, what happened was broadband was distributed, was placed by private sector companies. So they put broadband in the densest parts of the state where they could make the most amount of money. Why? Because from their point of view, you get the biggest bang for your buck in areas of density. If you look at those areas, those are the areas that coincidentally are the areas of the state that happen to be doing well. They're dense, there's a lot of commerce, there's a lot of clients for broadband. So the areas that got the broadband were actually the areas that were already doing well. The areas that didn't get broadband were exactly the areas that actually needed more assistance. You know? The market reinforced the market success. Where you had business thriving, communities thriving, they got the internet high speed. Slower markets, they didn't, which meant the slower markets were going to get even more slow. Challenge to us, challenge to Audrey, how do you incentivize the private sector companies to actually go to the areas that don't have a high economic impact? And that we're doing two ways. Number one, companies come to the state for merger agreements, approvals. Audrey's genius was, you want us to approve your merger? We'd love to approve your merger. We just want to make sure you are helping the state in this merger. And let me tell you how you can help the state. You can help bring service to places that are not currently served. The state also said, and there are going to be some areas that are just not economic for the private sector companies. To do rural parts of the county where you have to spend a lot of money to access the homes, and then you only have a handful of homes, that is not economic. And there the state said, we'll participate in subsidizing the providing of the service there. So that's the two-step approach, basically, that we've taken. That's what the legislature approved at $500 million to partner for the 100% broadband. The only state in the United States of America that is doing this is the state of New York, and we are doing it faster than anyone has ever contemplated. And it's just not access to internet, it's access to high-speed internet. 100 megabytes per minute per second is high-speed internet. And that's what we're providing. So it's not that we're putting in just access to internet and then 2 years later we have to upgrade it to high-speed internet. It is a game changer in that it totally flips the situation. I've always believed Hudson Valley, you want to talk about a place that naturally has all sorts of advantages for economic development. It's the Hudson Valley. It's one of the most beautiful places on the planet. What God created here was a masterpiece. It inspired schools of artists. People came from all over the world, right? Hudson River School, just to paint the natural beauty. The Hudson River itself. You have every advantage you could possibly imagine. And you have access to anywhere. You want to get to New York City to see a play, you can do it. You want to go north, you can do it. So it has every advantage that you could imagine. Michael Tucker's job should be very easy. Real estate market should be very easy. You have that big market in New York City, the residents looking for second homes. You have 50 million tourists coming to New York City every year from across the globe. 50 million. That's nice. Come see New York City. By the way, then come see the Hudson Valley and see why the artists and the sculptors all came to the Hudson Valley. And it's amazing how you can have that urban metropolis, but then just a couple of hours away, one of the most beautiful rural natural settings on the planet. So you had all sorts of advantages, but you have to be able to get there. And it's no longer the road system, it is having the internet system and the high-speed internet, which now equalizes the playing field. Because if I'm at my computer, in Columbia County, I can be in Manhattan, I can be in Paris, I am in this, wherever anyone else is, I am, for purposes of commerce and presence. And I think now you're going to see the natural assets come to the foreground because the negative has been resolved. And the speed at which this is done is amazing. You know, government, if it does anything, it's normally slow. And then late, right? Extended timeline, and then it misses the timeline. This is 2016, 2017. We will have 80% of it done, 2018, the rest of it done. So it is remarkably fast. And we're going to go from like 99% that doesn't have high-speed internet today to 100% having it in 2 years, which is going to be an amazing, amazing transformation. So, congratulations. I congratulate Audrey and her team, who did a great job. My colleagues in the legislature, thank you very much for the investment and the partnership in working this out and making this possible. And Michael, thank you for all you do. Thank you, and God bless you.
Welcome to the Public News Service Weekend Update. I'm Brandon Campbell. On this weekend's rundown, we're looking at stories from around the world, including Japan solemnly remembers the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. The U.S. could be taking in more Syrian refugees than originally planned. And we'll share a bit of Olympic history that may surprise you. Topping our news, this weekend, 71 years have passed since the U.S. deadly atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan during World War II. Officials in Hiroshima marked the anniversary by calling on world leaders to do more to get rid of nuclear weapons. Back in May, President Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the city. During his speech at that time, the president said, "We must pursue a world without nukes." The mayor of Hiroshima made similar remarks during a ceremony on Saturday and asked other world leaders to make their own trip to the city to show support. On August 6, 1945, the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima killed 140,000 people. Another 70,000 were killed 3 days later in a similar nuclear attack in Nagasaki. And in a statement, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said all of the world's nuclear powers have special responsibility to prevent another Hiroshima. And new numbers show the U.S. is on track to meet and possibly exceed its goal of admitting 10,000 Syrian refugees before the end of September. Many Syrians are fleeing violence in their home country due to an ongoing civil war that's left thousands dead. According to the U.S. State Department, more Syrian refugees have been admitted into the country in the past month than during the entire 7 months since President Obama gave the order. More than half are under age 18, and most are Sunni Muslims. This comes as Republicans have been ramping up concerns that Islamic militants could enter with those refugees. But the Obama administration says security checks have been rigorous and that hundreds of refugees have been denied entry after screenings. New York State has become a national leader for workplace policies that support families. We get more on that from Andrea Sears.
A new state-by-state analysis by the National Partnership for Women and Families gives New York an A-, just slightly below national leader California. Vicky Shabo, vice president of the group, says the Paid Family Leave Act that passed this year is one of the strongest in the country, offering 8 weeks of leave initially and 12 weeks when fully in effect.
And it will offer job protection, which means that people who work in smaller companies or have less time on the job won't risk losing their job when they need to care for a new child or a seriously ill family member.
New York's law, which goes into effect in 2018, makes the Empire State the fourth in the country to have paid family leave.
Aside from mortgages, student loans now make up the biggest piece of the debt puzzle in this country, and a new analysis finds people in Ohio are carrying some of the heaviest burdens. Mona Shand explains.
Collectively, Americans have more than $1.3 trillion in student debt, but it isn't evenly distributed across the nation. Jill Gonzalez with the online survey website Wallet Hub says Ohio ranks near the bottom, coming in at 42nd in the nation in her group's analysis of the best and worst states for student debt. This means high debt loads for former students.
When we're just looking at the average student debt, it's over $29,000. That's per borrower. And that makes up around 41% of someone's total income in Ohio. And this is a graduate aged 25 to 44.
The report found Ohio scored very low on such factors as the availability of grants and student jobs to help defray costs while people are in school. Researchers also looked at the unemployment rates for young adults, the percentage of students with past due loans, and the availability of jobs for recent graduates.
Disability rights advocates in Illinois are calling it a win this week now that the state reversed course on a no-overtime policy for workers who care for people living with disabilities. The decision Wednesday from the Illinois Department of Human Services came just hours before SEIU Healthcare Illinois planned to file a class action lawsuit challenging the overtime limits on the home services program. Disability rights advocates, including Gary Arnold with Access Living, say the restrictions could have left about 30,000 Illinois residents at risk of losing their in-home care providers.
So even if a personal assistant worked 41 hours, they would be issued one of these warnings. We could have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of people get their third strike and get their termination notice.
Earlier this year, the federal government ruled that all workers deserve time and a half pay for working more than 40 hours. According to the Associated Press, the state's Human Services Department will seek a new overtime policy through the Illinois legislature. And finally, all eyes are on Rio this weekend with the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games. But it's a decades-old fact about Olympic history that surprised filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper 4 years ago. Stephanie Carson has more on a part of history you may not know.
While researching a documentary on the Holocaust, Draper read a quick mention about the 18 African-American Olympians who competed in the 1936 Berlin Olympics and traveled back to the U.S. by boat. It inspired her documentary to be released this weekend called Olympic Pride, American Prejudice. Draper's work chronicles the racial challenges the athletes faced at home, only to be confronted with Nazi Germany. As for how what she learned will change how she watches the games.
I will watch these with great pride because those 18 athletes that broke the barrier,
they laid the groundwork for an American team that's so beautifully diverse and so richly talented with men, with women, with people of color.
Draper's film will show in New York and Los Angeles this weekend, with a national release expected this fall.
And that's our weekend update. I'm Brandon Campbell for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org. And if you want to help fund news that matters, please check out our campaign on Kickstarter.